This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 14th of September, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, it's another severe case of déjà vu in the Australian capital as Malcolm Turnbull sends Tony Abbott packing.
This will be a thoroughly liberal government. It will be a thoroughly liberal government committed to freedom, the individual, and the market.
Now, a change is often as good as a holiday, but Australia is welcoming its fourth Prime Minister in just 2 years. Is it a symptom of democracy gone bad? I'll ask my studio guests, John Everard and Ramita Navai. Also ahead, first it was Greece. Spain looks to be next, but will the UK follow in the rising of the political left? If the nation's new opposition leader is to be believed, the answer is a resounding yes. And as borders across Europe close, could freedom of movement across Europe be coming to an end? Plus, with the Iran nuclear deal done and dusted, just how cozy could relations with the US ever possibly be? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the former British diplomat John Everard and Ramita Navai, a freelance foreign affairs journalist and the author of City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death and the Search for Truth in Tehran. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to begin today in Australia. Well, leadership challenges seem to be almost as common as a midday sun in that country, but it would be remiss of us to neglect the dramatic events that took place earlier today when former Prime Ministers Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard were busy playing musical chairs in Canberra. Today's situation must have seemed an impossibility for Tony Abbott. But after the abrupt resignation of Malcolm Turnbull earlier today, the end for Prime Minister Abbott was indeed nigh. Defying calls for him to resign, Tony Abbott even vowed to fight the challenge, claiming he had the numbers to win. Alas, he was comfortably beaten by 10 votes. Anyway, forced him out, and he is the shortest serving Australian Prime Minister since Harold Holt drowned in 1967. Whew, that's a lot of musical chairs, isn't it? That's four Prime Ministers, John, in 2 years. Do you think they're getting a bit callous with their poor old Prime Ministers down there?
I don't know what's callous, but I think this kind of musical chairs, as you rightly call it, is frankly unhealthy. The prime ministers need time to bed down, to understand the way the system works. They need to gain experience. They need to get a team up and running. And changing prime ministers quite this often really isn't doing the Australian electorate any favours at all.
But John, if I bring in Ramita, you know, what's interesting is he's been a very polarising figure. You know, he's seen as, you know, very, very conservative. You know, he's been certainly unwilling to have any debate about, you know, socialist issues such as, you know, say, gay marriage. He's vehemently opposed to, the upping of migration. He's seen as a staunch conservative. Yet he hasn't kind of fared well in this time of, you know, dealing with the economy either. When you look at these characters like that, again, do you feel that he should have been given more of a chance, or do you feel that Australia was a bit mismatched with some of his kind of ambitions, really?
No, quite simply. I don't necessarily agree with Tony Abbott on all points. Let me get that firmly on the record. But as I said, chopping and changing prime ministers all so often as this is really not healthy. And yes, if one way or another Tony Abbott ends up as prime minister, he should have been given a better chance to show what he could do before being thrown out, becoming, as you rightly pointed out, the second shortest serving prime minister in Australian history.
Or Toby Abbott, as I managed to call him. Now, Ramita, when we look at him, as I said, yeah, it's interesting, you know, that he's been, you know, he's been seen as a very illiberal voice at times, and he's been criticised by many people, especially over his policies on immigration. Yet we think of Australia as this very young, contemporary nation. Yeah, I guess we judge it too much by life in Sydney rather than life in the outback. But when we look at Australia, do you feel that, in a way, they were mismatched with him? He feels a little bit of a kind of uncomfortable character in some ways to represent Australia on the global stage.
Yes and no. As you said, maybe he does represent the Australia that we don't see to some extent, especially the Australia with regards to its policies on refugees and migration. And while, John, you say that it's unhealthy, I agree with you, but you know, a lot of my Iranian friends would be very envious of this, because it certainly shows a real vigorous democracy at work here, the ability, you know, people power, the ability to change governments so easily and so quickly. And I guess like countries like Italy, that seems to change governments more often than Berlusconi changes his pants. So,
which is quite often, I would believe.
Yeah, yeah. There is some joy to be derived out of seeing a democratic country do this, even if you're right, even if it is quite an unhealthy thing to do, at least they can do it.
Yes, I unhealthy in excess. I mean, please, I'm not arguing for an Iranian political model here. far from it. But and the ability to change your leader is obviously the sign of a healthy democracy, but not quite as often as Berlusconi changes his pants.
Well, we should merge this conversation with something that's happened here in the UK at the weekend, where the UK's Labour Party has a new leader who's called Jeremy Corbyn. Now, he's a man...
Jez
we can.
Yeah,
Jez
we
can.
A man staunchly of the left, who's kind of everything that Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of the Labour Party, you know, didn't want to see entrenched in the party anymore. What's your view of him, John?
I think, I was using the word healthy and unhealthy just now in terms of Australian politics. In terms of British politics, this is healthy. Now, I do not agree with very much what Jez Corbyn says. In fact, I'm struggling to agree with any of it. But for the first time in a long time, the British electorate is going to have a crystal clear choice between two completely different political directions. We're no longer looking at two parties fighting over the centre ground. We are looking at a sharp political division and an absolutely clear choice, as I said. I was disappointed, having said all that, that in his shadow cabinet that all the traditional heavyweight jobs went to men. I think, you know, a lot of women would have felt that Jez Corbyn, of all people, was going to put more women into better positions of power. And I think there's a certain amount of angst at the appointment of his new shadow chancellor. I see that he's made the headlines of the Financial Times, a kind of tremor running through the business community. So there's quite a lot of noise and thunder going on at the moment, but hey, that's politics.
Ramita, do you think it's a good, healthy sign for British politics?
I do. I think it's really exciting. And I think it's a sign that people are not voting for personality here, because let's face it, Jez isn't the most charismatic of leaders. I certainly think he's principled. But I think that this is a real sign that people are voting for ideology. And that's what makes it so exciting. People are voting for really what they believe in.
I was intrigued to see that within hours, actually not quite hours, but you know, very shortly after Jez Corbyn's election, 15,000 people joined the Labour Party. I mean,
yeah.
the man clearly in across large and important swathes of the electorate is a rallying figure. There's a lot of people out there who are angry at the status quo, who feel that there must be a better way and want to give Jez a chance. And it's very good, very healthy that these people have a voice.
Yep.
What's interesting here in the UK, I guess, you know, the figure that oddly is most like him is Nigel Farage. Here's two politicians, one on the far right, one on the far left, who, if you ask them a question, they'll give you an answer. They won't kind of dodge the bullet. They're kind of, you know, they speak frankly, and they say some things which are not seen as perhaps, you know, palatable by middle England. Do you think that in its part of just a kind of a falling out of, you know, which has been happening for years, a falling out of, you know, favour of the political class, that we've kind of grown weary of the promises and the speak and the spin, that we want people who are a bit more genuine, even if when it comes to the crunch, they may not be, the, you know, we don't know whether in the end he's going to be elected?
I really hope so. I mean, I think that there's a certain weariness, as you say, over constant broken promises and constant populism, constantly trying to work out what people want and then trying to claim that you wanted the same thing all along. I'm all for a return to the politics of principle, of firm beliefs and firm platforms, whether of the right or of the left. I think that's a much better way to run a country.
But Ramita, it's interesting, you know, we're soon to have an election in Greece, for example. And then, you know, Tsipras called a snap election because he was so far ahead in the polls. I saw at the weekend, you know, his Conservative challenger is neck and neck with him now. And it looks quite likely that he may lose the election. So these populist, you know, these populist characters who kind of, you know, they're a vent for all the anger, for all the, you know, we don't like perhaps, you know, seeing services cut or people's wages trimmed. But in the end, when it comes to push, it's often quite hard for these characters to really form a consistent government, to get a following that goes beyond the party faithful.
Yeah, I agree. But I think with Corbyn, it's not about the character. Whereas, you know, and I think that there has been a shift. I think you could see with Blair, you could see why Labour lost the election. I think a lot of that was anger at Blair. Miliband, I think a lot of that was personal. I think with Corbyn, it isn't about him. I think it really is what he stands for. I think it's what you were saying, John, that it really is the people's beliefs now. It's ideology, and it is people wanting a shift to the left.
And how far left, though, do you think, John, the British people are willing to go? So, you know, and now this is, you know, slightly tabloid headlines, and, you know, he's a little bit more nuanced in what he says about it. But this is somebody who seems to be, you know, an unreconstructed supporter of the Palestinian movement. He has certainly been associated with people who are seen as anti-Semitic. You know, he has said things which don't seem to chime with the notion of running, you know, a capitalist nation. Do you think that in the end, that while, you know, yeah, we like his rhetoric around don't do austerity, give us a little bit more money, that when it comes down to those political issues, when he's put in the spotlight a little bit more, it will be more uncomfortable for him?
I think that there will be quite a lot of discomfort down the road. Whether what he says is going to appeal to the British electorate, well, we'll have to wait for the next election to find out, doesn't it? Don't we? I mean, the opinion polls suggest strongly that with a platform such as Jez Corbyn is working up, it's going to be very difficult for Labour to win an election anytime soon. But okay, you know, the man has principles, he stands for them, and I admire, as I've just said, somebody who operates in that way and doesn't try to bend those principles so as to bring in people who don't necessarily agree with him.
Ramita, does it bother you that he, you know, he didn't bother then to put a woman in one of the top five jobs?
It does bother me. I don't think necessarily... I don't think he's sexist. I don't think it's because he has sexist policies or he's a misogynist, but I think he clearly has... There are clearly internal issues at the moment. Clearly... It's very fractious for him at the moment, and these are fractious times. So I think, you know, only time will tell. I hate that expression, but it's true. We'll really have to wait and see what happens.
John, do you think there's any traps in here for David Cameron? You know, he is a slick politician. You know, let's not doubt he is a man of principle as well, but he comes, you know, across with his kind of Etonian charm, and he's perhaps not so good at connecting always with people in the way that Corbyn is. Do you think that he will deal well with this rival?
I think the challenge goes wider than just a challenge to David Cameron. I think this is a challenge to the entire Conservative Party. You see, for a long time, large parts of the Tory party have defined themselves about as being almost anything except for Labour. Now, if what we see is an actual... A sharp shift to the left by Labour, so moving away from the centre ground and posing much less of an electoral threat to the Conservatives, then I think that the sticking plaster that has bound the Conservative Party together for so long is liable to come adrift, and that we are likely to see, probably as soon as the next few months, splits within the Conservative Party, possibly fatal ones. It may be that what we're witnessing now is not just a move to the left by the Labour Party, but a restructuring of British politics as a whole. I think this is a fascinating time.
But both of you say it's great that we have this kind of now division, this clear polarity. But when we look back, you know, the times of, you know, Thatcher versus the miners, wasn't that what everyone hated? That there was, you know, the far left, and there was the, you know, there was a very right-wing Conservative Party, and that's what allowed in the end, you know, the Liberal Democrats to come up through the middle. It created the newspapers like the Independent, where, you know, people were desperate for the opposite at that point. They were desperate for some consensus politics, people who didn't only answer to the, you know, the drum of their own political party. Are we going to end up back there again, do you think?
No, I don't. Firstly, I disagree with your analysis. I don't think that people hated the fact that there was a clear right and a clear left. I think what they hated was the way that both sides behaved, and, you know, the viciousness of politics at the time. As many other countries have shown, it's perfectly possible to have parties that disagree fundamentally on major issues who still don't slide down to the levels of political mudslinging that we saw under Thatcher and between Thatcher and the miners. You said just now that in that situation, the Liberal Democrats came through the centre. quite possibly that will happen again. OK, so we end up with a right, a left and a centre.
Yeah.
Go with it.
Absolutely. I think it'd be really interesting to see if the Liberal Party will be reinvigorated. And I think what people hated was the fact that everything was so grey, that New Labour and Conservative, you couldn't really tell the difference between them. And I think that's why this is so exciting and that's why people want this.
Well, it's been a time of musical chairs both here in London and in Australia. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, John Everard and Ramita Navai. Coming up next is Borders Tighten and Passport Controls in Greece, is Europe's freedom of movement showing signs of wilting?
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
You know, Tokyo is fantastic. It's a very grown-up city, you know. It's not a sort of superficial love for Tokyo. It grows, and that's what's really kept me here for so long. So it's just great to live here. Fantastic. I love it. I never get sick of it.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and still with me are John Everard and Ramita Navai. Now, we're going to look at the breakdown of the so-called Schengen Agreement, which has allowed movement between the 26 signatory countries without border checks, without even having to show your passport. But Germany now has moved effectively to suspend the Schengen Agreement because it cannot cope with the vast numbers of refugees, it seems, crossing its borders. Is it gone forever? Will it come back? Was it a good thing or was it not? John, Germany's moved to do this because it feels that the quantities of people coming across the border are just too many for its infrastructure to cope with. And I guess it's trying to force some of the other countries along the route up to Germany to deal with some of the issue themselves, whether that's Austria, Serbia, Hungary. Do you think this is an agreement that will, in effect, be gone forever soon?
No, I don't. I think that this has been very heavily overblown. Schengen, I believe, is here to stay. What we're watching is a temporary blip under immense pressure. It may be that at the end of all this, we end up with a Schengen where you are actually required to show documents as you cross a national border. But, I mean, it's perfectly possible to have a right to travel around the European Union freely and to work anywhere in the European Union and still have to show a passport at various checkpoints. I don't think that would actually bring the house down. I suspect that is somewhere near where we're going to end up.
Ramita, you know, it has been a key cornerstone of the European project. Do you think it's important that we keep it?
I think it's absolutely important, and I think that border controls won't make any difference to the refugee crisis or to the flow of migrants and refugees. I covered this eastern land route, this exact route, in May this year. Even then, there were hundreds of refugees passing from Greece to Macedonia, which is a non-Schengen country, and then Macedonia to Serbia, which is a non-Schengen country. What will happen with border controls is that it'll be an absolute gift for people smugglers and for the Albanian mafia who were involved. And what was remarkable was this whole area that I was covering was controlled by Afghan people smugglers. Bits, you know, swathes of fields and woods that the Greek police wouldn't accompany me into because they were scared of armed Afghan people smugglers. And you know, Greece is a Schengen country. And the flow of migrants, the flow of refugees into these non-Schengen countries was just, you know, unabated and unstoppable.
So, John, we know that, you know, some 14,000 people arrived just at Munich Hauptbahnhof on Saturday, another 2,000 or 3,000 on Sunday. That's what triggered the kind of decision to give the authorities a chance to kind of catch up with the numbers. What do you feel is the narrative that we're seeing here played out? Because, you know, as Ramita says, if it's impossible to stop the people coming, if it's so kind of such a business now with so many people making money along those routes, what's the end game here? Is it just, you know, to say, in effect, we allow whoever wants to come? Or do you do something to control the flow of people?
Now, if I could answer questions like that, the simple answer is that I don't know. Nobody knows. There is no plan for an end game, which is perhaps the single biggest factor in this situation that worries me. That there's been this immense emotional reaction. You know, these are people in need. We need to help them. And as you just said, Ramita, in any case, they're highly organized. It's very difficult to stop them, even if you so wished. But even if we somehow manage to absorb the tens of thousands flooding through now, what do we do with the next 100,000, the next million? Now, Africa is full of people desperate to settle in Europe. And the barriers to this transit, especially with the collapse in Libya, have all but disappeared. Nobody seems to have any idea what the end game is going to be. I think that's just a little bit worrying.
What do you think, Ramita? The flow of people, is it... I guess there are people looking at this in different ways. There are people who's feeling, yes, refugees, people who are fleeing conflict. We need to do as much as we can to help those people and make sure that they're in a place of security. But what is happening is it's very much becoming an economic story as well, isn't it? And I guess a freedom story. People are only wanting to go to one or two countries, to Germany or Sweden, where they feel that they will have, you know, good opportunities and the state is set up to run it. They're not just looking for refuge. There is an economic story here again. Again, it's the question no one can quite answer. But what do you think should be the end game here, that people should just be allowed to come, that there should be a quota system?
Well, I disagree, actually. I think that this is a refugee crisis and people are seeking refuge. From what I saw, there were few economic migrants. Most of the people I met, even if they had come from camps in Lebanon, they were fleeing horrific conditions. They, you know, so many people I had seen. Is it the president of Hungary recently said, Prime Minister, President of Hungary had said...
Viktor Orban, yes.
Yep, he recently said that... that no, you know, these Syrians are fine. They've come from cozy camps in Lebanon. It's not true. I met so many Syrians who had fled from Kobani, who had lost so many loved ones. I met very few economic migrants. And let's not forget that refugees, most refugees, they want to go home. You don't want to leave your motherland. We've seen this with Polish migrants to this country. People don't stay forever. You know, the pull of the motherland is very strong. So I disagree on that point.
Yeah. I could just point out that the logic of what Ramita is saying is that the only way we're going to stop this happening is by preventing the Russians arming Assad and allowing the war in Syria to come to its natural end, and allowing people homes to go to.
You're absolutely right. The way to stop this is at the source.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, we're talking about an end game, and something else we must talk about is the fact that, you know, Syrians want to go home. When are they going to be able to go home? Not for a very, very long time.
But then, strangely, you were both saying how interesting it is, you know, that someone like Jeremy Corbyn has come to power. Here's a man who's made in the past it clear that he feels it would be quite a good thing for Britain to have no army, certainly never to be involved in any country overseas. So if you're looking to some of these new politics coming up, they're not going to come to the rescue either. There is no appetite amongst these new populist parties to do anything about Syria on the ground. Yes, except refugees, but certainly not get involved in anything with Assad.
You keep calling Jez Corbyn a populist. I don't think he is. I think the man actually has principles. I think we were just talking about that.
Well, I mean, he's tapped into a popular feeling, which is one of outrage. I think there's one feeling of outrage about austerity and feeling that something should be done. But I don't know that he, you know, when you hear what he's said on record about what he thinks about politics. I don't see from him, and without his backing, there's certainly no way that the Conservative Party here in this country, for example, could lead any coalition to, you know, to start wading in to try and depose Assad. And, you know, in the meantime, we're stepping aside, and the game seems to be getting longer and longer. The Russians are putting people on the ground. They're arming Assad more and more. There's no quick solution happening on the ground that's going to stop this migration flow.
That is the point I was making. I mean, the core is the key to an early end to the Syrian fight is to stop the Russians doing what they're doing. And heaven knows how you do that. There's no way that any Western power, with or without an army, is ever going to intervene if it means going toe-to-toe with the Russian army. We do not want to start World War III over this. We're having enough problems as it is, thank you. But come back to the point you started with, Andrew. Yes, I mean, from everything that Jasmine Corbyn has said, I really don't see how, you know, Prime Minister Corbyn could ever cope with what is being thrown at Europe now. His policies seem to just miss all the key points.
Well, I think we've got some more to say about this over the coming days. But finally tonight, we're going to look at the state of relations between Iran and the US. It wasn't so long ago that any suggestion of cooperation between the pair would have been met with scoffs of disbelief. And yet, after Barack Obama's victory with his nuclear deal, hopes are rising that the countries might enjoy increased diplomatic ties. The New York Times published an interesting article today pointing out that the American troops advising Iraqi security forces in the Anbar province are sharing a base with Iranian-backed militia that once killed US soldiers. With that in mind, how close can the relations between the two countries become? Ramita, we must start with you. What's your view about this cozying up?
Well, it's not surprising, and it's not the first time that it's happened. So we mustn't forget 2001, pre-nuclear deal. The Iranians, when relations were very frosty indeed, Iranians and Americans negotiated and shared intelligence over the Taliban. ISIS really has been a gift for Iran, who's Iran has been wanting to come in from the cold, and they now have a shared enemy. And the Americans and the Iranians have been sharing airspace. You know, American special forces have been sharing the battlefield with Iranian Quds military men. So this is not new. And yes, there is going to be greater collaboration between these two historic arch enemies. I think there's also going to be negotiations and collaboration that we don't hear about, because, of course, both sides have to keep their right wingers happy. The conservative hawks and the hard Iranian hardliners that don't want detente, that don't want a cozying up of relations.
John, do you think this is a good thing, or, you know, it's useful in the battle against ISIS, but we know that on the other hand the Iranians would rather Mr. Assad stayed in power, so it's more complicated than just, you know, aligning yourself in the battle against ISIS.
It is very complicated. Is it a good thing? Yes, it's a good thing. I mean, I think, you know, having any diminution of the conflict between the United States and Iran is, any way you cut the cake, is a good thing. The limitations to this cooperation are quite clear. I mean, I agree with everything that Ramita just said. There are going to be areas where the two are never going to agree. But can we remember that, just now you said, you know, they were arch enemies. The last time I was in Iran, Iran and the United States were the firmest of allies. I haven't been back for very many years, it's true.
When was that?
just before the Shah fell.
That's
wow,
quite a long time
well,
ago.
And so you were there at a time when they were allies with Israel.
That's right, yes. Let's not forget that point too. Thank you for pointing that out. But the point I was going on to make was that even at that time, closest of allies, huge symbolism of great friendship, that Iran and the United States sparred over different regional interests all the time. I mean, you can have a warm relationship where you disagree on certain key issues. You know, that's entirely manageable. A lot of countries do this. And it may be towards that kind of situation that we are slowly moving. The other element here that I don't think has been brought up much in the media is the internal dynamic in Iran. I mean, Ramita, you'll know much more about this than me, but it seems to me that Iran is changing, and that, you know, over the next several years, we may actually be living with quite a different Iran from the one we have now. Do you think that's right?
I don't think it's changing as much as people believe it is changing, or it may change. Personally, I don't think so. And I think we mustn't forget that the internal battle between the hardliners and the reformist pragmatists is very real. And the hardliners are kicking back. The hardliners are not happy. There are a lot of noses out of joint over this, not least Revolutionary Guards. Sanctions have been great for a lot of Iranian regimes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really lined the pockets of a lot of people in power. So I think change will come much more slowly than people imagine.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. John Everard and Ramita Navai, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. As I said, that's all we have for on the show today, but it was produced by Ben Ryland, research by Fernanda Augusto Pacheco and Ada McLaughlin, and our studio manager was the one and only Toby Hammond. For the next half an hour, Chris Lord will bring you his company and his music with the playlist, and then at 1900 hours, it's Mr. Robert Baum. But for me, goodbye.